Turn with me to the 13th chapter of the book of Exodus. You might say this is a continuation of the story. This is the Feast of Unleavened Bread. We understand what it means. We understand that it was for the children of Israel. It was a reminder, an annual memorial of a very special event in their history. One that in many ways defined their relationship with God and defined in many ways the covenant itself that God would make with the people of Israel. You know, you go through the book, the Torah, and as far as that goes, the prophets, and you'll see these repeated references again and again. You see references to the Exodus. Now God reminds them, I brought you out of the house of bondage, out of the land of Egypt. Over and over, you see this connected with the Sabbath day. You see it connected not only with the Feast of Unleavened Bread, but with other festivals and many other aspects of the law. It even talks about how you're to remember that you were a servant, a slave in Egypt, and you're to treat the stranger in your land accordingly, just like you would like to have been treated when you were in Egypt. So you might say the covenant God made with Israel once they were in the wilderness was in many ways Exodus-centered. That means to say simply that that was God's great act of redemption in the Old Testament in bringing the people out of slavery and delivering them from Egypt, bringing them into the wilderness and up, ultimately, of course, into the land of promise. So this was God's great act of redemption, and we could say then that the Old Testament, the Torah itself, is largely Exodus-centered. So I'd like to continue that story. We began early in the Passover season, or as we were approaching the Passover season, we took a look at the Passover event itself. We noted that the people left their homes in Goshen, in Ramses, and they began the journey. And now then we continue that journey, and beginning in chapter 13 and verse 17. It says, when Pharaoh let the people go, God did not lead them by way of the land of the Philistines, although that was near. If you have a map, I don't know if you have a map in your Bible there. Some Bibles have very handy maps, but you will see where Israel began, roughly where the location of Ramses was. And if you look at the land of Canaan, if you have a map there, you look from from Egypt to Canaan, you see it would be a fairly short journey if they took the scenic route, not the scenic route actually, but if they went by way of the coast or near the coastline of the Mediterranean Sea, and they could zip right on up into Canaan, and they'd been in the Promised Land. But they didn't go that way because there was fear. There was fear that something might happen. Let's just go ahead and read the account here. For God said, lest the people change their minds when they see war and return to Egypt. In other words, they would see the threat. This was a well-fortified area. There was a trade route there, or a caravan route that went from there all the way up to Canaan. So that would have been the ideal way to go. That would have been the short route, almost like the crow flies, you know. But no, this God, the people would have been fearful, so God says, we'll send them a different route, a different way. Now, keep in mind that even though this, it says here, and this is true, that it was because of the people would be fearful, and they might, if they saw what, you know, the threat that was there that lay along the path, that they might then be tempted to turn around and go back to Egypt. But remember, God is sovereign. He's in control here. He has something else in mind. So he uses this situation to send them by a different path, and he is doing something in order to bring about his will. It's not just because the children of Israel were afraid. That's part of the reason. But God is going to use this occasion to make a point, to bring about something in the immediate future, to bring about a certain condition, to fulfill his will. But it looks beyond the immediate. It looks all the way out to, well, quite a bit into the distant future, as we shall see later. So what God has in mind here is more than just in order to satisfy the people because of their fearfulness. More to it than that. There's a plan at work here. Continuing on in verse 18, but God led the people around the way of the wilderness toward the Red Sea. The word here is Yam Suf. That sounds like some kind of Klingon command, but Yom Suf, it's translated here Red Sea. There's some controversy as to how it should be translated. Some say Sea of Reeds is a better translation. In any case, we do know that the Red Sea itself had a couple of gulfs coming off of it. You had the Gulf of Aqaba to the east side, and the Gulf of Suez on the west side of the Red Sea. And many people think that the Exodus took place, or the crossing of the Red Sea took place in the Gulf of Suez. Others think, no, it was in the Gulf of Aqaba. But in any case, I, by the way, don't believe it was either one exactly. But maybe I'll comment on that as we get to it a little bit later. But anyway, the term here, again, the term is Yom Suf, and it can apply. What I was about to say was that this term, if you look through Scripture, see how it's used, it can apply to either branch, either of those arms, and it can also apply to the body of water that Israel crossed when they crossed the Red Sea, whatever that means. But in any case, that's the term. Continue reading here. And the people of Israel went up out of the land of Egypt equipped for battle. Listen, they were equipped for battle for sure, but I can assure you that they were not equipped to battle the Egyptians. They knew the Egyptians had better techniques for battle. They had better equipment, better equipped than they were. But they went out equipped for battle anyway. It goes on to say, verse 19, Moses took the bones of Joseph with him, for Joseph had made the sons of Israel solemnly swear, saying, God will surely visit you, and you shall carry up my bones with you from here. And they moved on from Succoth and encamped at Etham on the edge of the wilderness. And the Lord went before them by day in a pillar of cloud to lead them along the way, and by night in a pillar of fire to give them light, that they might travel by day and night. I don't think this means that they were constantly traveling through the night, day and night. Some people have assumed that. But if that's the case, then what are these encampments about? No, I think there was some travel at night, but it does not that they can travel, that they travel continuously day and night, day and night. That's my opinion. The pillar of cloud by day and the pillar of cloud by night did not depart from before the people. Obviously, this in itself was a miracle. They could see that. The same God who delivered them from Egypt, who struck dead the firstborn, brought them out of that place, and now is providing this for them. You know, that speaks loud and clear, doesn't it? They know, they surely should know that God is with them. And yet, in spite of so many things that they had seen, they would from time to time begin to complain and say, you brought us out here to die. You know, wonder they're worried about dying when the fact that God had delivered them over and over. Continue on in verse chapter 14. It says, then the Lord said to Moses, tell the people of Israel to turn back and encamp in front of Pihahiroth, between Migdol and the sea, in front of Baal Zephon, and you shall encamp facing it by the sea. For Pharaoh will say of the people of Israel, they are wandering in the land; the wilderness has shut them in. Now, this is what he's aiming for. You know, they could have taken the short path, gotten on out of there. And God could have dealt with any threat along the way, but he chose not to do that. Because the people were fearful, he said, okay, we'll take you by a different route. We're going to take you down so we can get you hemmed in next to the sea. Well, on the surface you think, that's a great plan. Down there, so we're trapped. And so there they were. So God has a plan in mind. He has something in mind. He intends to do something for his own purposes to bring about a condition, a situation that will result in himself being glorified. But it's not just that he always sought self-glory. That's not the point. The point is it would have an effect on people. You'll see how that plays out. And you'll also see it reflected later in the account that it looks beyond the immediate future. It looks to a time yet to come. But then he continues on, says, again, verse 3, for Pharaoh will say of the people of Israel, they're wandering in the land, the wilderness has shut them in. Now think about this. You know the king of Egypt was not exactly the humblest man on earth. In fact, he was a guy, like many other kings, that was filled with pride. And his pride had been, I would say, damaged rather badly in what had happened to him. Because here you had these Hebrew slaves led by Moses, and he was defeated by their God. He and the gods of Egypt were all defeated. And it was kind of like it's a public spectacle now. The other nations are hearing about this. So now it's time for vengeance. Time to take revenge if he can possibly find a way to carry that out. And it looks like he's got the way here. They're trapped. And God says, "And I will harden Pharaoh's heart, and he will pursue them." And here's the point. This is what God is doing right here. "And I will get glory over Pharaoh and all his host." That's what he's aiming to do. "And the Egyptians shall know that I am Yahweh." And they did so. So this is his purpose here. So look, I'm going to let you go down by the sea. I'm going to let it appear to be that you're trapped here. You know, this is the way it's going to look to Egypt. This is the way everybody's going to think of it. In fact, the people of Israel thought the same as well. But they thought they were trapped. The Egyptians thought they were trapped. Now then, Pharaoh's got them. He can take vengeance. He can pay back time is here. And God says, "I'm going to get glory from Pharaoh in this. And then all the Egyptians will know who I am. They'll know that the God of the Hebrews is, in fact, the true God." Verse 5, "When the king of Egypt was told that the people had fled, the mind of Pharaoh and his servants was changed toward the people. And they said, 'What is this we have done, that we have let Israel go out from serving us?'" You know, they were all ready to let them go when the firstborn died. But now they're kind of changing their mind again because they think they see an opportunity. "So he made ready his chariot and took his army with him and took 600 chosen chariots and all the other chariots of Egypt with officers over all of them. And the Lord hardened the heart of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and he pursued the people of Israel while the people of Israel were going out defiantly." Now, when it says he hardened Pharaoh's heart, how do you think he did that? It's no big deal one way or the other. God has the power to reach into somebody's heart and mind and manipulate it if he so chooses. He's, after all, God. But, I think what really the story is telling us here is that God hardened him by creating this situation. In other words, he knew the heart of Pharaoh, and he knew that if he created a situation where it appeared that the children of Israel were now trapped, and Pharaoh could now come and take vengeance, then this was how God hardened his heart. It's not that he reached in there necessarily and threw a switch or two and said, hardness switch on, softness switch off, or something like that. "The Egyptians pursued them, all Pharaoh's horses and chariots and his horsemen and his army, and overtook them and camped at the sea by Pihahiroth, it's hard to pronounce some of these words, in front of Baal-zephon. When Pharaoh drew near, the people of Israel lifted up their eyes, and behold, the Egyptians were marching after them, and they feared greatly. And the people of Israel cried out to the Lord. They said to Moses, 'Is it because there are no graves in Egypt that you have taken us out away to die in the wilderness?'" So here they are again. Here they are. You're taking us out here to die. Yeah, we've seen the cloud by day, the fire by night, and we knew what happened in Egypt. We saw the plagues. We saw the death of the firstborn. But now then, we're out here. You want to kill us? So this hardness of their hearts, this lack of faith, pops up again and again throughout the Exodus, throughout the story here in the book of Exodus and elsewhere, throughout the wilderness sojournings, and even in the land of promise. That's why they got driven out so many times. But in any case, here you see that same thing being expressed. Well, let's take up the account down in verse 15. It says, "The Lord said to Moses, 'Why do you cry to me? Tell the people of Israel to go forward. Lift up your staff and stretch out your hand over the sea and divide it, that the people of Israel may go through the sea on dry ground.'" You can almost hear the music in the background, can't you? But I don't think anybody could have commanded the waves as well as Charlton Heston could. I don't think anybody else could have played that part so well, even though I'm pretty sure that Moses didn't actually look or sound like him. But that's what comes to everybody's mind. In fact, you see depictions of Moses, and almost always they use some scene from that movie. What if it had been some other actor? What if they'd chosen someone? Can you imagine a different one? Arnold Schwarzenegger, for example? If he had been Pharaoh, and then Moses said, "Let my people go," what he would have said? "Stay here." The Hebrews would stay here. Would not let them go. Or what if it had been the Ten Commandments starring Clint Eastwood as Moses? That would have been a good one, wouldn't it? Can you imagine? "Let my people go, punk." Anyway, Charlton Heston is the one that can do it best. But anyway, let's go on here. So, continuing verse 17, said, "I will harden the hearts of the Egyptians so that they shall go in after them, and I will get glory over Pharaoh and all his host, his chariots and his horsemen. And again, the Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord when I have gotten glory over Pharaoh, his chariots and his horsemen." So he wants the Egyptians to know that he is God. The gods that they had worshipped are not gods. He is God. He alone is God. And not only that, we're going to see a little bit later that he wants other peoples to know who he is as well. He wants other peoples to see his works in Egypt and what he's about to do right here, so that they will know, so that the Canaanites will know, so the Moabites will know that he is God, because they're going to hear about these things. And that's his purpose right here. But I tell you again, though, that he is orchestrating all of these things because he has a purpose that goes beyond the immediate future, even beyond the future for Israel in the centuries ahead. Is something that goes all the way down to our future. He has a purpose for all of this. And he goes on to tell about how all this was to take place. Verse 21, "When Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and the Lord drove the sea back by a strong east wind all night and made the sea dry land, and the waters were divided." This is one of the reasons that I've always doubted when I have seen, and I know it's all over the internet, the chariot wheels at the bottom of the Red Sea, that's the Gulf of Aqaba. I don't believe those are chariot wheels, not for a moment. If you ever checked out what happened to the Titanic, and it wasn't as far back in time as this was, what salt water does to it, I don't think those are chariot wheels that some claim that they photographed down there. But the other thing is, it tells you right here, I take it taking it face value, now God could do anything God wants to do, but it says that he drove the sea back by a strong east wind all night. You know what kind of wind it would take to drive back the waters in the Gulf of Aqaba? That's a deep, deep, deep water. And do you think you're going to walk through that while the wind is blowing? No! I don't think so. Now, unless God performs a miracle, that is possible, but no, I think what it's telling us here is that God sent this east wind, and it caused that night, and remember, they left by night, they were about to cross over, and it caused the waters to move away, you know, to part. But you know, I don't think they were extremely deep. I'm not saying that they could have easily crossed it. They couldn't have. Because after all, you had a whole nation that was facing this sea. It may have been what we would call a big lake, but they were facing this. And it obviously was deep enough that they couldn't cross with women and children, old people, you know, elderly, with carts. And they had their flocks and their herds with them. So they did appear to be trapped. But probably this was one of those lakes north of the Gulf of Suez, which by way of canals connected to the Gulf of Suez. And that's probably where they crossed. It might have been not a salt water. If it was the Sea of Reeds, it wouldn't have been salt water, because reeds don't grow in salt water. But in any case, It was probably one of those bitter lakes north of Suez. That's my opinion. And so when the east wind came, it blew the waters, formed a wall, but not a straight-up wall like you see in the movies. I think what you're talking about is you could see the water rising on each side because the wind was strong enough to keep it blown apart like that for some distance. You know, probably a gradual rise, not so much a straight up and down wall. Although it's described as a wall. But there would be, because you see waters on each side of you, it would be that way. And of course, when the wind stopped and it came crashing back together, you're talking about deadly force there. Even if it's not a very deep lake. But in any case, that's just my two cents worth on that, because it comes up all the time and people, there's stuff all over the internet about it, but that's my thought on it. In any case, God caused this miracle to occur, and the waters did part, and it says, verse 22, and the people of Israel went into the midst of the sea on dry ground, the waters being a wall to them on their right hand and on their left. The Egyptians pursued and went in after them into the midst of the sea. I guess they figured, we don't know exactly what's going on here, but they're going in, we're going in too. All Pharaoh's horses, his chariots, and his horsemen. And in the morning watch, the Lord in the pillar of fire and the cloud looked down on the Egyptian forces and threw the Egyptian forces into a panic, clogging their chariot wheels so that they drove heavily. And the Egyptians said, "Let us flee from before Israel, for the Lord fights for them against the Egyptians." So they figured it out that, hey, he's on their side, not ours. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Stretch out your hand over the sea, that the water may come back upon the Egyptians." And this is important to realize, too, that God is doing, his actions are done through an agent here. He's using the agency of Moses. Because in so doing, he's identifying Moses before the people. This is the guy I'm working through. And you can see, of course, that Moses then is a type of Christ. A type of Christ. You see God the Father working through Jesus Christ in similar ways. So you see Moses as a type of Christ here. So stretch out your hand over the sea, that the water may come back unto the Egyptians upon their chariots and upon their horsemen. So Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and the sea returned to its normal course when the morning appeared. And as the Egyptians fled into it, the Lord threw the Egyptians into the midst of the sea. The waters returned and covered the chariots and the horsemen, all of the host of Pharaoh, and followed them into the sea. Not one of them remained. So they got hit with a double tsunami as the waters came back together, as the wind stopped blowing. And so God defeated them in that way. But the people of Israel walked on dry ground through the sea, the waters being a wall to them on the right hand and on the left. Thus the Lord saved Israel. Here is the redemption. Here is the salvation. That this event, as I said before, this event is central to the covenant, and in many ways central to the Torah itself, because he repeats, refers back to it over and over again. It's the great redemptive act of God. He overthrows the enemy and he saves his people. And you'll see that theme coming up again and again. Thus the Lord saved Israel that day from the hand of the Egyptians, and Israel saw the Egyptians dead on the seashore. Israel saw the great power that the Lord used against the Egyptians. So the people feared the Lord. That's another positive effect there. The people feared the Lord, and they believed in the Lord and in his servant Moses. So you see the positive effect that this is having as God orchestrates these events. It's for their benefit. It's for the benefit of the Egyptians. They were still back in Egypt because they're going to hear about it. It's also for the benefit of other nations. They're going to see this and realize, understand, that the God of the Hebrews is in fact the true God. He's vastly more powerful than any of their gods. Now then, you have this interesting section here. I'd just like to go ahead and read through it. It's called the Song of Moses. And what it is, it's a song of praise because of what God had done. Glorifying God's name because of what he had done for them in this event. Chapter 15, then Moses and the people of Israel sang this song to the Lord, saying, I will sing to the Lord, for he has triumphed gloriously. The horse and his rider he has thrown into the sea. The Lord is my strength and my song, and he has become my salvation. This is my God, and I will praise him, my father's God, and I will exalt him. The Lord is a man of war. The Lord is his name. Yahweh is his name. Pharaoh's chariots and his host he cast into the sea, and his chosen officers were sunk in the Red Sea. The floods covered them. They went down into the depths like a stone. Your right hand, O Lord, gracious in power, your right hand, O Lord, shatters, or glorious in power, I say, your right hand, O Lord, shatters the enemy. In the greatness of your majesty, you overthrow your adversaries. You send out your fury. It consumes them like stubble. At the blast of your nostrils, the waters piled up. The floods stood up in a heap. The deeps congealed in the heart of the sea. The enemy said, I will pursue. I will overtake. I will divide the spoil. My desire shall have its fill of them. I will draw my sword. My hand will destroy them. You blew with your wind. The sea covered them. They sank like lead in the mighty waters. Who is like you, O Lord, among the gods? Who is like you, majestic in holiness, awesome in glorious deeds, doing wonders? You stretched out your right hand. The earth swallowed them. You have led in your steadfast love the people whom you have redeemed. There's that redemption theme again. He redeemed them. He bought them. He paid the price, as it were. You're going to see this a little bit later, too. To bring them out of the bondage to the land of Egypt. You have guided them by your strength and your holy abode. The peoples have heard. They tremble. Pangs have seized. Now get this. The inhabitants of Philistia. This is his object right here. This is what he wants from all of this. Pangs have seized the inhabitants of Philistia. In other words, they see what has happened. They now hear the reports. They know what has happened. The God of the Hebrews has delivered them. He has destroyed, he has defeated the Egyptian army. Now are the chiefs of Edom dismayed. Trembling seizes the leaders of Moab. So you see these people in that land that they're about to go to, all of these peoples, the Moabites, the Edomites, the Philistines, all these other people, they are trembling in fear because they know what has happened. They've heard the reports. All the inhabitants of Canaan have melted away. So now they hear the reports and they know what's coming. This nation is coming to take your land. Terror and dread fall upon them because of the greatness of your arm. I say your land. Of course, God had promised it to them. They've heard of this. They know this. They know of the promises given to Abraham. And they're still as a stone. Till your people, O Lord, pass by, till the people pass by whom you have purchased. So there's that redemption theme. You will bring them in the plant. You bring them in and plant them on your own mountain, the place, O Lord, which you have made for your abode, the sanctuary, O Lord, which your hands have established. He's talking about bringing them into the land of promise, establishing there, making a kingdom of them, as he had promised to do. It says, the Lord will reign forever and ever once he establishes them in the land. You see how this looks beyond the immediate future. Beyond just merely satisfying Israel's needs at the moment, it looks to the time of entry into the promised land and to the time God will establish Israel as a kingdom. But beyond that, this expression, the Lord will reign forever and ever, it looks beyond the establishment of ancient Israel. It looks to the future. It looks to God's ultimate purpose. And in fact, as you read through this, you realize that God is orchestrating these events, bringing these things about in a particular way so that this will have an impact on us. We're going to see that in just a little while. But before we go to 1 Corinthians 10, where that is basically stated, I'd like to go over to the book of Revelation. With all of this in mind, keeping in mind that as we observe this last day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread, and it's very, very probable that this was the day that God parted the seas, the waters of the Red Sea, the Sea of Reeds, whatever you'd like to call it. But when he parted those waters and delivered Israel and destroyed the Egyptian army in the sea, apparently that happened on this day, the seventh day. But even if it didn't, still that event is pictured in the Feast of Unleavened Bread. It's something that Israel was to forever look back to. And it's extremely important. It's important to us because it also parallels and it reflects God's actions in the future in dealing with his people now and in the days ahead. Go to Revelation, the book of Revelation. Let's take a look there at beginning in verse, see where we want to start here. Let's, first of all, just a summary of chapter 12 toward the end. After the devil is cast down, the serpent of old is cast down, and he unsuccessfully goes after the woman. That is the woman who gives birth to the male child who's caught up to heaven. Of course, that refers to Jesus Christ. But after unsuccessfully pursuing the woman, it says he turns. He's in great anger, of course. He knows his time is short. So we're told that he turns his attention toward the rest of her seed, the male child being the seed of the woman, and turns his attention to the rest of her seed, the rest of her offspring, the brothers and sisters of Jesus Christ. That's the church. That's the true church, the church of God. He turns his attention to these people, those who keep the commandments of God and have the faith of Jesus. And then you take up the account in chapter 13. We won't read the chapter, but here you see how the devil goes after the woman. He has an agent. It's one that bears his image and likeness. You know, the devil is described as a dragon having seven heads and ten horns. And now he calls a beast out of the sea that has seven heads and ten horns. This is symbolic of a government structure. And of course, this is the agent he will use in pursuing the rest of her seed, the people of God. Just as Pharaoh and his armies pursued the devil, you might say, used Pharaoh and his armies to pursue the Egyptians. So now you see the devil using this agency, this governmental agency, to pursue the people of God. And then you see the second beast that comes up out of the earth. This is the religious arm. Pharaoh had his religious arm in Egypt. He had his priests, his magicians. And so the religious arm is the promoter of the government and uses the government to accomplish its purpose in persecuting and hopefully destroying, hopefully from his point of view, or its point of view, the system's point of view, destroying the people of God. So these are the agents that the devil uses in pursuing the people of God. Then in chapter 14, it breaks in to give a proleptic picture of the outcome. Some people read this sequentially as if these were describing things going on in a sequential way, but this is not necessarily the case. Chapter 14, the vision that is there of the 144,000 with the Lamb, this is a proleptic picture. In other words, it breaks into the story to point to the future. This is the outcome for the people of God. Just as in the time of the Exodus, in the time that they passed through the Red Sea, you might say he broke into the story and said that I may establish my kingdom forever and ever. He's looking to the future. He's looking to Israel's future. He refers to their coming into the promised land. Of course, this is proleptic because it looks to that time when the people of God will be in the kingdom, when this mortality will have put on immortality, and so on. But in chapter 14, they're described as 144,000, said to be on Mount Zion with the Lamb. It says, let's just break into the story there. Go ahead and read the first few verses. Then I looked, and behold, on Mount Zion stood the Lamb, that's Jesus Christ, and with him 144,000. I believe this is a symbolic number. It refers to the fullness of the people of God. 144,000 who had his name and his father's name written on their foreheads. And this is in contrast to the name of the beast, or the number of his name, which the name, mark, and number of the beast described in the previous chapter, it all refers to the same thing. It's the name of the beast. So the followers of the beast have the name of the beast written in their forehead and their right hand. This calls attention to, well, this anciently, this sounds like a tattoo that was used to mark slaves with. Now, whether that's what it manifests itself in that way in the end, that's another subject too. Don't care to get into that. But the contrast here is the people of God have God's name and the name of the Lamb in their foreheads, not the name of the beast. So they have submitted their will to God and the Lamb, whereas the other group has submitted their will to the beast. That's the point here. So they stood with the Lamb and with him 144,000 with his Father's name written in their foreheads. And I heard a voice from heaven like the roar of many waters, like the sound of a loud thunder. The voice I heard was like the sound of harpists playing on their harps. And they were singing a new song before the throne and before the four living creatures and before the elders. No one could learn that song except the 144,000 who had been redeemed from the earth. It is those who have not defiled themselves with women, for they are virgins. What does that mean? Well, in context, this talks about this mystery Babylon who is described as a great harlot. This is speaking in spiritual terms. They have not defiled themselves spiritually with this false system, the great harlot, or her harlotress daughters. So they're spiritually pure. That's the point here. It is these who follow the Lamb wherever he goes. These have been redeemed from mankind as first fruits of God and of Lamb, and in their mouth no lie was found. They have not been deceived by the devil's lies. So they're pure. They're spiritually pure and not under deception, as is the rest of the world. For they are blameless, it says. And then you have the three angels' messages, warning of things to come. And you have a harvest of the earth, but I want to drop on to chapter 15 to get to the point. John says, then I saw another sign in heaven, great and amazing, seven angels with seven plagues, which are the last. For with them the wrath of God is finished. So now the culmination of all things is coming its way. It's about to occur. The wrath of God is about to be finished. God's purpose is about to be accomplished, at least for this age. And I saw what appeared to be a sea of glass. Here's another proleptic picture of the people of God. Again, proleptic, meaning it points to the future, designed to encourage those who have been under persecution, those who, like the Israelites of old, were oppressed in the land of Egypt, were also oppressed by the beast power, by the worldly system, by the devil and all of his activities. He says, I saw what appeared to be a sea of glass mingled with fire, and also those who had conquered the beast and its image and the number of its name. I mean, they stood strong, they stood faithful in spite of the oppression, in spite of the persecution. They didn't grumble, they didn't complain like so many of the Israelites did, but they stood strong. They were standing beside the sea of glass with harps of God in their hands. And they sang, get this, they sang the song of Moses. That song we just read. They sang the song of Moses. What for? Because like the Israelites who had been delivered by God's miraculous power, brought through the Red Sea, brought safely to the other side, and destroyed the Egyptians, so now these sing the song of Moses because it's time for the seven last plagues to befall their oppressors. And they will have deliverance. You see the pattern, the same pattern that's there? And how that looking at Moses as a type of Christ, looking at Pharaoh as a type of perhaps of Satan, Egypt as a type of this worldly system, and how all of these things work together, and you see that God was actually orchestrating events back there so as to create this picture that would be instructive to us. After all, it's the same God working out the same plan, and you would expect to find the same patterns along the way. And that's what's going on here. So they sang the song of Moses, the servant of God, and The song, another song there they sang too, the song of the Lamb, saying, "Great and amazing are your deeds, O Lord God the Almighty. Just and true are your ways, O King of the nations. Who will not fear, O God, O Lord, and glorify your name?" There it is again. That's the purpose of all this. You know, the seven plagues, all these plagues described in Revelation are not for the purpose of taking vengeance on people. Just like, why did God destroy the Egyptians in the sea and deliver Israel? So that the nations would know, so that the Egyptians would know, the Canaanites would know that He is God. And so the seven plagues here, these seven last plagues, in addition to the other things that have been described here in the book of Revelation, are for the purpose of showing the nations who God is. Same pattern. "Who will not fear, O Lord, and glorify your name? For you alone are holy. All nations will come and worship you." This is what they're looking to. This is going to be the outcome of all these plagues, of God's actions in the earth, of His orchestrating these events, not causing evil men to be evil. He doesn't do that. But He uses those men just as He used Pharaoh. "All nations will come and worship you, for your righteous acts have been revealed." So the people will know, the nations will know, that indeed the God of these people, these persecuted people, the followers of the Lamb, is indeed the true God. Now, with all that in mind, go back to 1 Corinthians 10. This is something I covered in a message in Tyler right before the Feast of Unleavened Bread, but it's a very important message to us here, what Paul says concerning those events that happened back then, concerning those very events that we are, that this festival memorializes. 1 Corinthians chapter 10, Paul says, beginning in verse 1, "I want you to know, brothers and sisters, that our fathers were all under the cloud and all passed through the sea." He's talking about that event that we just read about a little while ago, the Red Sea or Sea of Reeds. "And all were baptized into Moses." You see how he's drawing the analogy here. Moses was the agent God used then. They were baptized into Moses. And of course, we're baptized into Christ. "They were all baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea, just as we're baptized in water and the Spirit. And all ate the same spiritual food," meaning the supernaturally provided food, the manna in the wilderness and so on. "And all drank the same spiritual drink," meaning the supernaturally provided drink, the water that came forth from a rock. "For they drank from that spiritual rock that followed them, and that rock was Christ." Nevertheless, and you see, this is the analogy here. The rock that Moses struck in the wilderness, this pictures Christ providing for His people. Okay? "Nevertheless, with most of them God was not pleased, for they were overthrown in the wilderness." You know, after seeing all of these things, after experiencing the power of God in delivering them and overthrowing their oppressors, here they get in the wilderness, and what do? They turn to idolatry. They turn to immorality. They turn to rebellion. Kind of shows what was in their hearts all along, what had been there apparently for some time. Partly picked up in Egypt, perhaps partly picked up as they made their way through the wilderness, through the desert, as they came in contact with other peoples, other nations, idolatrous nations, and thought they wanted to have the things that they had. Which is something, of course, that can happen to us, as we're surrounded by influences in this world. And it goes on to say, in verse 6, this is the main thing I want to call your attention to. It says, "Now these things took place as examples for us," is the way this is translated. But literally, the word is tupoi, or types, typos. These things happen, meaning the events themselves, as orchestrated by God, took place as types of us. that we might desire, that we might not desire evil as they did. In other words, that we should learn the lessons that we see as we look back at these forerunners of us, these types, these representatives. It's telling us that we need to be able to read the story and see them as types of us and learn the lessons from it. So are we grumbling in our wilderness journey? Are we accepting of the way God handles things, of His commandments, of the way He would have us live? Or would we rather conform to the world? That's a message that's here. So the Israelites, Moses, Israel, all that took place back there, as orchestrated by God, served as, and God had this in mind at the time. He knew where His purpose was taking him, or taking the world. And He knew, I'm not saying He necessarily knew us by name, but He knew that His people would eventually exist. His New Testament, His New Covenant people. That Christ would come, that there would be a church, a people. And that they would inherit His kingdom. That's even referred to right there in the Song of Moses. So now these things took place as types of us that we might not desire evil as they did. Do not be idolatrous as some of them were. As it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. He's referring to several things that happened once they got out of Egypt, once they were now in the wilderness, and even though they had received God's law, instructions from God Himself, and entered into a covenant, nevertheless they did these things. We must not indulge in sexual immorality as some of them did, and 23,000 fell in a single day. We must not put Christ or the Lord to the test as some of them did and were destroyed by serpents, nor grumble as some of them did and were destroyed by the destroyer. Now these things happened to them as an example, but they were written down for our instruction. So when not only did these things, did God orchestrate events in order that they might be written down in a certain way and preserved, the story might be preserved for us, but these now are written down for our instruction. If anybody tells you that the Torah doesn't have any application for us, that's about an ancient people, lived a long time ago, is not related to us, they need to read the New Testament. They need to read what the apostle to the Gentiles had to say about it. No, it is for us. And these things were written down for our benefit. And he says, on whom the end of the ages has come. If Paul perceived that he was living in the end of the ages, what about us? We're not further away from it than he is, are we? No, I don't think so. And this is an important lesson here. Therefore, let anyone who thinks that he stands take heed lest he fall. That tells me you can fall. If you think you stand, you need to examine what you're standing on. You need to take a look at your foundation. You think you stand, take heed, you could fall. And that's exactly what happened to the Israelites in the wilderness. It says, no temptation, no testing, no trial has overtaken you that is not common to man. So everything that happened to you is things that have been happening since time immemorial. God is faithful and He will not let you be tempted or tested beyond your ability, but with the test, the temptation, He will also provide the way of escape that you may be able to endure it. And you know, this harkens back to the Exodus, doesn't it? You see how it looks back to the Exodus? Because there were all kinds of testings placed before the people of Israel. And again, you bring us out here to die? They didn't do so well, did they? And He's reminding us, that should tell us, those things that happened to them back there should tell us that God will deliver. May not be exactly the way we think He ought to do it. We may not take the short path to the promised land, but He will get us there. We may have to go through a whole lot of, pass through a number of Red Seas, as it were. But He'll get us there. So if you think you stand, take heed lest you fall, but always remember that any test that comes your way, God will ultimately deliver you. He may let you go through a lot. You know, He lets us die. But God will deliver us. That's what He's saying. He's encouraging faith. He's promoting. He's encouraging these people to depend on God, to put their trust in God. Therefore, my beloved, flee from idolatry. I speak to sensible people. Judge for yourselves what I say. And then he goes on to talk about some other things related to this. But the point here is, look, you keep your eyes on God, away from the world. Don't follow the example, the bad example of Israel. But learn from the things that they experienced as they came out of Egypt. When they passed through the Red Sea, came into the wilderness, encountered God at Mount Sinai, received His law, all of these wonderful blessings, and yet they still turned to idolatry and other things in contradiction to God's law. So the lesson for us is, let's look at them as a type of us. They're a type of us. And let's learn from the type. Look at the good things that happened then, but also look at the bad examples and the problems they got themselves into because of their lack of faithfulness. And that's a major lesson in this Feast of Unleavened Bread.